In any case, this talk is called The Greatest Show on Earth, and the picture in question is from a movie, Freaks, 1932. And really, it's about a bunch of experiences that I've had in terms of event organization, including an event at, is anybody here familiar with the Hackerspace Noise Bridge in San Francisco? Okay, so if you, so I ran an event there called 5 Minutes of Fame for almost 2 years before I passed it off to somebody else, and a lot of this talk will be the underlying philosophy and principles behind what went into the creation of that talk and how we did all the promotion for it and what goes into an event itself and all the cool things you can do once you have a level of stability with it. So can you turn up the microphone for the first slide here? Test, test. All right. So this first slide is kind of an example of what can happen if you put your mind to it and do something crazy. Can you hear that? Anyone know what that is? Yep. That gets really interesting. Yeah. I'll be covering this in more detail, but I just wanted to give you a taste of the kind of stuff that we do. So, first slide, about me. I am not an objectivist, first and foremost. I know the movie Atlas Shrugged just came out. Anybody here familiar with OpenAMD? You may have seen flyers floating around. We did the RFID badges at the Last Hope and the Next Hope conferences, and we also did the CCC Sputnik. It's basically location tracking and RFID, location tracking, social networking stuff, and it's a lot of fun, and I'm trying to pimp it out to get sponsorship, so see me after if you're interested. I'm also involved with 2600's Hope Conference, and I can see Shardy laughing at me from the audience. Yeah. Past that, I'm a frequent Nauticon attendee and speaker. I think this is my sixth Nauticon. It's my fourth time speaking here. Past talks have included, I did a talk on the temporary autonomous zone. I did a talk where I humiliated Shardy, and a couple of other things. And I've been coming to these types of conventions for about a decade now and doing different types of talks, some of them technical. This one, not as technical, but getting into the more social developments and applications that come around through the conference and the makeup of it. So the first and foremost, the thesis statement of this whole talk, it's about creating events, right? Well, what is an event? So I want to define an event as a novel or significant, memorable shared experience. And this gets into the next interesting question, which is, in order to have something which is novel or significant, you must have that which counteracts it, which is routine. And anybody, how does routine develop? Anyone? By default. A routine is something that you kind of fall into, you get used to it, the novelty wears away and dies, and it just becomes kind of the way of your life. And events, at least the way that I'm defining them, is a way that you can break out of routine and do really cool kick-ass things. So I want to interpose that there are two types of events. There are one-offs and recurring. So to give a quick example, how many here are at Nauticon for the first time? Cool. And how many people have been here before? There you go. There's the difference. It's the same event, but the difference is completely subjective. It's within your own perception of it. So all of you who are here for the first time, hopefully you'll come again. But if you don't, then this may be a one-off. Or maybe the event doesn't happen again. Hopefully Nauticon will. But other events do have just one-off for whatever reason. Maybe it's a funeral or a wedding or something like that. Whereas a recurring event tends to happen over and over again, and the event itself becomes that which upholds the reputation. So let's go into some examples of events. So we have conferences like Nauticon. Something else I have a past in is organizing raves and electronic music events. Classes or workshops, netcasts, flash mobs, high school or going to work. Does anybody see any questions about whether any of these events fit in? I hear mumbling. Let's see. Anybody? The ones I wanted to point out are high school and going to work. Anybody have any ideas why? They're very recurring, exactly. And the question being, what is it that defines an event? And like with high school, for example, if you look back on your high school experiences, eventually when you have this recurring pattern, it forms an event in and of itself, which comes into the next idea that events are not necessarily time, they're not limited by time. An event could last 4 years, an event could last 10 years. An event can be a pocket of time that you refer to with a singular label. Going to work is an interesting one. How many people would consider going to work a novelty? What about going to work for the first time? The first time you do so? Exactly. It's completely new, you don't know what you're getting into. Starting a new job, it has all the novelty. How many people here have started out a job and it's been really amazing, and then 3 weeks later they hated it? Well, you're lucky, sir. So it really means the event itself is not that which dictates the one-timeness or recurrence, but it's more your own experience within it. And that's something that I really wanted to emphasize. So the next reporter question here, why would you create an event? You want to fill a need in the community, to change a community, to create community, to fix something and make it better, and most importantly for me is to have fun. So the one thing I want to emphasize here, it's not about money. And this is really important. I've seen a number of people come into different types of communities and attempt to organize or run events to make money, and it never really works. The example that I can give to remain diplomatic, within the rave community, I've seen a lot of people attempt to throw raves to make money. And if you actually do the math behind all this, is the microphone on, by the way? Can I put this down? Okay. Within the rave community or the nightclub community, often you'll have an event that happens and you have headliners that come in and all these other things. So if you look at the door cost, you have money coming in from the bar and you have money coming in from the door. And if you look at the cost, you have to rent the venue, you have to pay off the headliners, you have to pay the sound, and any other expenses that may come up, like permits and whatnot. If you look at the input and output of that money, it never really adds up. So you don't throw an event to make money, and if you do, you're getting your money from somewhere else. And within the rave community, I'm just gonna gloss over that one. But bottom line, you do this stuff to have fun. You do it because perhaps you're driven to do it. Like, look at Froggy. Why is he throwing Nauticon? It's not because he's making money off of this. It's because he loves the community and he loves enabling people to come together and to share this experience. So the next question, who? Who do you create it for? And this is where ideas and symbols come to mind. Okay, who recognizes that? Really, half the audience? You guys suck. Okay. What do you guys think of when you see that symbol? What's that? Corporate greed? Okay, I was thinking. Okay, so no child porn or anything like that. Great, okay. Headless Walt Disney. Sure. And the question is, how do you gear this towards the audience that you're trying to find, right? So with Disney, I generally think of two things. I think of targeting a movie towards kids and towards families, and then I look at what they created in the 1940s, and I'm like, okay, so they hated Nazis too. So the next question is really, which audience are you trying to entertain and why? And you can take the same idea and recraft it in different ways. For example, if you take a flyer for an event and you put different headliners on it or you put a different image on it, you will get a completely different demographic. That's really important for different types of talks and whatnot. So you would take a flyer and set it in one way to attract a technical crowd and another way to attract like a craft or an arts crowd. So, and I understand that this stuff is kind of dry and boring. I'll go through it as fast as I can. So, a few quick lessons learned here. You'll never please everyone, ever. There's always going to be some asshole who pipes up and they have some way to complain about it. It's also okay to make mistakes. A lot of people don't realize this and they try to be perfect. If you try it, what you try doesn't work, you know it doesn't work, and you suddenly have this mental tool set for future events. And it's really important to make the right mistakes and to learn from them. I've made many, many mistakes. For example, when I was doing 5 Minutes of Fame, we started out the first few events and we had a projector going like this, right? But we'd never thought about doing a speaker light, which wound up turning into, we had the lights off and you had this shadow, the silhouette of a person that would just sit in there and there was no way to see who they were. And vice versa, having the lights on while the presentation is up. Maybe they're playing a movie. You can't see the movie. So you have to like watch this and learn from your experience and figure out what works and what doesn't. So there are two ways that I generally define success. The first is the immediate, where the audience claps, and the second is the long-term, where they process. Anybody have examples of this? I have a very interesting one, but 2 p.m. audience. Is anybody here familiar with the play Death of a Salesman? Okay, cool. Death of a Salesman was written by Arthur Miller in the 1950s. The first time it showed, the premise of the play is basically the American dream and what it really is, and it delves into the ideas that there's no such thing and it's all a big lie. And when it was first shown to audiences, they were silent. They had no idea how to handle it, and they had to process it, they had to sit there and think about it, and they had to kind of engulf all of the ideas behind it. And that's one of the things that I really enjoy doing. And here's an example. What do you guys see there? 3D glasses. So to give you the full story behind this, as I begin to delve into story mode, so this was the first event that we did at the new Noise Bridge when we moved to the bigger location. When we started doing 5 Minutes of Fame, we were in this tiny little 1,000 square foot venue, and we didn't really have a whole lot of room. We had all this stuff that was kind of jammed into it. And one of the cool things, as we started experimenting, I realized that we had two projectors, one on top of each other, that were projecting like the slides or if anybody wanted to hold a class or workshop. And one of the things I remember way back when I was making rave flyers, anybody familiar with anaglyphs? Okay, one person. Basically, the way 3D glasses work is you put it on, you have the different spectrum. It's actually two images that are juxtaposed on each other with different filters, and it tricks your eyes with depth perception, and it gives you this illusion that it's 3D. So when you put those glasses on, it's actually emphasizing which comes first, and it creates this notion of depth. So given that there are two layers there, looking at the projectors that there were within a Noise Bridge, I was like, hey, we have two projectors. I wonder if we could take the projectors, put them on top of each other, put a different filter on, and create 3D. So that turned into a really interesting idea, and this will get into the next segment I'll discuss later. But September 17th, 2009 was the 150-year anniversary of Emperor Norton's ascension to the throne. I'll get into him in a bit, too. But we wanted to do something really special, something people would remember. And keeping in mind that we were playing with that idea before, we came up with this notion of an intro video, something that you put in front of before the presentation to get everyone excited about it. And we created a 3D video and got a whole bunch of 3D glasses, and we got everyone to wear 3D and try to make it look sort of like the stuff in the 1960s. It succeeded to some extent, but it looked really cool, and everyone really enjoyed the experience of getting to put on the 3D glasses. So the next real question here, did it work? Fancy and flashy shows are fun, but people forget them after they've seen them. And anybody here familiar with the fourth wall? Within Shakespearean times, you have the box, you have the sides and the wall and whatnot. So you have the back wall, the front wall, the left wall, and the right wall. And the purpose of the notion of the fourth wall is the wall which is between the audience and the speaker, or the audience and the player, whatever it is. So the idea being that to engage your audience or to engage the people involved, you take away this imaginary fourth wall, and they become one with the show. A good example of this is within a movie, there's this notion called suspension of disbelief, where you're looking at the screen and you see all these actors and they're playing out these lines that they've memorized, but you forget about that. And you just kind of fall into the notion that, yes, I'm part of this and I have vested emotional interest in what's going on within this movie. And it's really important when you take that into consideration. Well, as a performer or an artist or whatever you are, you're trying to take down the fourth wall. You're not always the one who puts it back up. And that's why engaging the audience is really important. So done with a lot of the fundamental stuff, the how, where, and when of this is the rest of the talk. So get into the philosophy and inspiration behind it. Does anybody recognize either of these two symbols? Ah, yes, okay, Marcel Duchamp. Yes, a reproduction, yeah, it's a ready-made. So one of my big inspirations in this is Marcel Duchamp and Dadaism. The other one is John Cage, who I'll get into in a second. he really inspired me and a lot of the work that I was doing within the event. So some explanation here. This is called the fountain. Basically, Duchamp in, I think, 1917, took a urinal, turned it on its side like 90 degrees counterclockwise, and he wrote the word Armut on it. And he set it up on a pedestal, and he said, hey, this is art. And half the art community was like, oh my god, you're a genius. Half the other half was, dude, you're a douchebag. What the hell is this? And it brings up a very interesting question of what is art and whose perception of art counts. Do you guys, who thinks that's art? One, two. Who thinks it's stupid bullshit? What? It's completely subjective, and that gets into the notion that art in itself is completely subjective. Right. One of the things that they were doing back in the Dadaist era is taking some object and maybe turning it or putting something else on it and saying, hey, this is art. And a lot of people got upset because, you know, there's this whole training that's involved in creating a professional artist. And
it takes no skill to take a urinal and write something on it.
Right.
Yeah.
But does skill make something art? And who determines what's art?
What?
But it's getting you thinking about that, which is the whole purpose of the art piece. So the guy on the right here is Emperor Norton I, the protector of Mexico and Emperor of the United States. Anybody familiar with him? One, two, three. Okay, you guys all rock. Have you guys read Sandman by Neil Gaiman? Yeah. So this guy is also one of the actual I lived saints in the Church of Discordia. But, oh, I heard, okay, yeah. Basically what happened, this guy, 1850s era, he comes to San Francisco, he's a business dude, and he makes bad investments, and he winds up completely broke off his ass, and he's all depressed, and he's trying to figure out, well, what do I do next? So after some thought, he kind of goes bonkers, and he writes a letter to the editor of the San Francisco Chronicle, declaring himself the Emperor of the United States and Protector of Mexico. And the best part being, given the nature of San Francisco, everyone went along with it. Everyone, he would walk through the streets, he would wear this majestic, as you can see, emperor uniform, and he would have people address him as Your Highness. And they went along with it. He issued his own currency and stores took it. That's the extent to which this guy was doing craziness, and he's absolutely brilliant. So the letter to the editor that he issued, it was September 17th, 1859. So when we did the 5 minutes of fame on September 17th, 2009, it was the 150-year anniversary of his ascension to the throne to the day, which is pretty badass, which is ultimately why we did that. Other things that he did, he would issue royal proclamations, and there's all kinds of little pockets throughout San Francisco that have memories of him. So he's one of my inspirations. The other two, anybody notice that picture on the left? There's Ed Bernays. This guy, Ed Bernays, was involved in media and PR back in the 1920s. When World War I came along, the Germans kind of destroyed the meaning of propaganda to an American audience. So he had to come up with the term public relations to continue going on. He created a new symbol to get around the idea that the first symbol, the word propaganda, had the negative connotation to it. So he turns around, comes up with public relations, doing the exact same thing, but under different auspices, and people are, oh, okay, great. So this is one of the more famous examples of some of his early work. This is from the 1929 Easter Parade in Manhattan. In the 1920s, there was this taboo against women smoking. And what he orchestrated in this, as you can see, there is a woman who looks fairly well-to-do walking next to somebody who looks like an aristocrat, and she's holding a cigarette in her hand. They took a couple of photos of this in the parade, and there were some other photos of women who were in positions of power or who looked very powerful and looked mighty, all holding cigarettes. And overnight, when this was published in the newspapers, in the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal, overnight it broke the taboo on women smoking. So the final inspiration here to the right, anybody recognize that? Yes, John Cage, 4:33. Basically, he wrote this song that was 4 minutes and 33 seconds of silence. Getting back into the Dadaism ideas, he gets everyone together, and then he's like, oh, okay, cool, I'm gonna play a great piece. flips open the piano, and then just like sits there for 4 minutes. And it turns out that what he was getting at is that the music that he is composing is actually that of the crowd and the sounds of the people. He has somebody coughing, somebody hiccuping, things like that. Again, this pissed off a lot of people because they said, dude, that's bullshit. So some last bits of philosophy and inspiration here. Discordians. The notion behind Discordian, it's a religion that was created in the 50s, basically to make fun of all religion. And Discordians dance the fine line between consistency and breaking structure. Structure being something you've come to know and accept as true or a given. And that gets really important as we get close more into this. And the final thought I want to bring towards with philosophy and inspiration, once you have something that works, you're no longer building it. Do you guys agree with that?
No.
Okay. Disagreement. Why?
Because you're iterating on a design. Mm-hmm. You want to create something that does something, and you want to make it better. And
okay.
If you are making something better, you're building.
But who is building? What I'm getting at here is what you're building is a frame. And once you have that frame and that initial instantiation of it, then you can make an iteration, a variation of it on theme, but it still goes back into the same notion.
So are you modifying at that point?
Sure, absolutely, you're modifying.
Okay.
So, yeah? Okay. So now I get into the real meat and juice of this. Has anyone here ever thrown an event? Sweet, okay. How did you guys all promote? Twitter, okay. What's that? Mailing list, okay. Anyone else? Flyer in, okay. Okay. What did you guys find worked and what didn't? Targeting specific
flyer.
Groups.
Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's an art show, but we focus the art show around maker culture, you know. Mm-hmm. But it was kind of loosely defined. What exactly is maker art? So when we were targeting artists, people were submitting things that we were like, we had sort of like a committee, well, this quite isn't maker art, but, you know, that was picking straws. I was under the idea that if anybody made this period, therefore it's maker art. But when we were flyering, I thought that we should be hitting the art museums, the art school, coffee shops. There's a local tobacco shop where a lot
okay.
of...
So let me pause you for a second, because
yeah.
what you're getting at is totally spot on. And the real question is why. One of the reasons I put Ed Bernays as an inspiration is because in his book Propaganda, he goes into this notion that within any social group, you have leaders and followers. Does anybody disagree with that? Okay, cool. I wouldn't listen anyways. But you have leaders and followers, and more importantly, you have social hubs and people who listen to those social hubs. For example, does anybody here know who Cory Doctorow is? Okay, a good chunk of the crowd, large enough to call him a social hub. If anybody's heard of Boing Boing, it's the same general idea. So this gets into the notion of promotion. There are so many ways to do it. There are flyers versus word of mouth. So the difference between flyer is something which has information on it that you pass out to somebody. And some of the things I actually learned when I was doing flyering, because I've done a lot of it. For example, if you have an event that you're trying to promote, I live in the Mission District in San Francisco, and I'll have an event, and I bring the flyer in, and usually a place will have like a flyer table or maybe a shelf that you can put flyers on. So you can, you know, go in and sneak up and put it on the table and just kind of leave. I always insist that people who are doing promotion for my events go to the person who's working there and ask if it's okay.
Yeah.
And there's two reasons for that. First, it implies that, yes, you have consent, you have permission, and you're doing due diligence as a responsible organizer. And the second, when you ask them for permission, you're informing them, and that means they know about it. That means they're that much more likely to tell somebody, because if you don't know about something, you can't tell it to somebody else. You can't have that shared experience of, hey, this is really cool, you should come.
Right.
Yeah, what?
I do that type of stuff in marketing, computer services, and that type of thing, also because it shows a respect for the business owner, and they appreciate that, and they're less likely to throw your flyers away.
Right. And that gets into something else, which if you look at the social structure within, say, a coffee house, no matter what the actual social demographic of it is, whoever is working there is considered the leader. People are going to listen to them. And if they tell them, if you tell somebody, hey, can you move that chair over there? They're going to do it. They're going to listen to you. And there's this notion of assumed authority. And when somebody has authority, people listen to them. So one good example of ways that I've promoted is, does anybody know about the HOPE conference besides what I just showed up there? So the way that I promoted that for the last HOPE when we were doing all the RFID badges, we did RFID triangulation, it was really cool. Going back to Cory Doctorow, at the time, he had this book called Little Brother that had just came out. Anybody familiar with this? Okay, a couple people. Little Brother was targeted to like 13-year-old kids to teach them, hey, here's all this technology and here are all the ways to get around it. Here's surveillance stuff, it's really scary, but you can actually get past it. And it was a way to empower these little kids. He was doing a book signing in Union Square in New York City, and I'm thinking, if there's anybody who's going to be interested in this project that we're doing, which is basically tracking people and this privacy stuff, it's going to be him. So I went to the book sign-in, got the book signed, and casually mentioned, hey, do you know about 2600? And he's like, dude, yeah, I've totally written for them. And that's a good sign. And then I mentioned something about the badge project, you know, the 10-second elevator pitch, and he totally loved it. Emailed him, and from then on, every announcement that we had about HOPE made boing boing. And I'm pretty sure that that really helped a lot of the pre-sale, and it helped a lot of the things that happened in the event. So there's definitely some truth to that logic. People here who have used Twitter and Facebook, hands? Did you guys have success or fail?
Bit of success.
Bit of success.
People are like, yeah, attending, and you'll expect, oh, there's going to be 150 people attending, and then it's like, oh,
right.
Wait a second, it's not that many, so it's not really reliable. It's a good way to get the word out, and, you know, they'll see that, my friend is going to this event, so maybe I should check it out. So we got some success with that, not so much with Twitter.
Right, and, yeah, okay, another point?
Again, in terms of marketing computer services, I'm a web developer, so one of my projects, which is half functional, is I will develop a website where I show presence and have all the features that you would see on a normal social network, blogging and pictures and video and that kind of stuff, and then create accounts on the social network sites to try to simply point back to that website, simply using them as a network for drawing traffic to the primary website.
No, those are all very good points. And now I'm going to completely badmouth the social network and stuff. So Twitter, for example, if you take these systems and you look at the actual makeup of them, Twitter is basically 10-second headlines nonstop. It's like if you look at a newspaper, you see a headline, okay, I'm interested in that. But with Twitter, you have this whole list of headlines that's coming down, and you might be interested in one. You're about to click on the link, but you see another headline that also looks interesting, which means that you have this 5 to 10 second period where you have the ability to capture, where you have the ability to capture somebody's attention, and then it goes away. And unless you have something really, really good, and usually the only things that fit that are controversy and drama, if you have a cool project that might, but bad and drama is a lot more attractive than good. So, yeah, question. Meetup falls more into the stuff I'm going to talk about Facebook in a second. Yeah.
But the power of Twitter, you're saying a 10-second, you know, clip. The power of Twitter really comes in the retweets and the media.
Absolutely, which is...
Say targeting social lots of leaders, if you can make sure that a certain group of people that are interested in the community already follow, say, the Twitter feed that you're going to be announcing something for, you get a lot of retweets through those things. That instead of having 10 seconds, you actually build a discussion that's going on. People are getting bombarded throughout an entire day or a week or whatnot with things like this, and it creates an interest that, you know, can be created without an SIP.
Right. The gentleman has just captured the point that I was going to make about the one good benefit of Twitter is that if you capture everything correctly, and say you have a group of 20 people who are suddenly engaged in a conversation, say some news drama happens, say Libya gets bombed, all these people are suddenly discussing it, or you had the TSA rape kit, stuff like that. That's a way to keep people's attention because it gets them emotionally attached to it. It's just like if you have a classroom where the teacher asks all the students a question, or the teacher says, okay, I'm about to do a puzzle here, or I'm about to do a problem on the board. who here thinks it's going to be this, who thinks it's going to be that? Even though it's a tiny little thing, by involving yourself into it, you have a tiny bit of emotional connection to it. And once you have an emotional connection, you're more interested in what the outcome will be. So when you have a controversy or a debate or any kind of conversation going on, or you issue a statement and somebody responds to you, you want to respond back. And then you want to see what they're going to say back to you. And it engages a social interaction, in a sense. What? Exactly. You should drink some more, Charity. But so that's really one of the few good ways. There's two good ways to harness Twitter. One of them is by creating controversy or having conversations of some sort going back and forth to keep it within the public eye. Because if you have that 5 to 10 seconds, but you multiply it by 20 or by 50 tweets, suddenly that turns into a couple of minutes, or that time stretched over. When you see something over and over again, this is one of those ways in which you can take routine and ideas and symbols and turn it into something which you have established trust in. I've seen that a couple times. I want to check it out. When Node.js was coming out, I think it's still kind of on the rise. I've heard about it probably from 20 different people. I finally decided to go check it out. How many people came to Nauticon because like 5 people nagged them? Okay, 1 person. Good enough. The other way to do so is targeting social hubs, going back to the Ed Bernays standard, where you get somebody like Cory Doctorow or somebody like, Obama makes a tweet. If you have 1 million followers, then it's much more likely that people are going to pay attention to it. But by that point, rather than looking at this instant headline system, you are looking at a headline distribution system. And by virtue of the fact that that person or that icon, that name and that face becomes the icon and the symbol that you're looking at, by the virtue of that fact, they've already established a reputation. Anything that they say, you're already interested in what it is, and you already have some degree of credibility and trust and emotional involvement in it. So Facebook has one key difference, and that's the event invites. And those are pretty badass. Reason being is rather than seeing this immediate headline, a Facebook event invite is a static piece of information where I can click through and invite a bunch of my friends, and I have the RSVP list so I can see who's coming to it, which is effectively the same thing as doing a search on Twitter to find out, okay, Nauticon, let's see who's there. Well, they're talking about it. Maybe they are, maybe they aren't. The other thing about the Facebook event invites is that it tells you information about the event. So the date, the time, it's effectively a flyer that's static and on the internet. So it's effectively, if you think about it, a website promoting the event that also has a list of all the people that are going to be attending or who are potentially interested in it. Exactly. Or another trick that I've used, if I want somebody to go to an event, I can tell them, hey, you should go there because this person that you know or that you want to hang out with is going to be there. It's the same idea. So that's all about event promotion. And really the way that I did it with 5 Minutes of Fame is I went to every fucking event in San Francisco and I badgered people nonstop. You have to become that guy. You have to become the person who is known for the event, because that way, people need a central point of contact to go to for anything. So for example, if you come to Nauticon, if you want to give a speech, talk at Nauticon, you have to submit an email to the call for papers. You can't just email anybody who's on the staff. And it seems like a really stupid example, but it's really important if you think about it. Because everything is going to one person who you know is in charge of something, has the authority and the knowledge to handle that. So when somebody's face or somebody's persona becomes identified and coupled with that idea, suddenly you know who they are, you know what they're about, and when they come and you have something of interest that you want to say, hey, I'm interested in speaking at your event, or I'm interested in collaborating with you on this project, you go to them and they're going to be able to help you. It's way, way better than going to some random person and saying, hey, are you interested in this? You already have some degree of knowledge about who they are and what they do. So does anybody have any more comments on that before I move on to another comment?
One of the tricks that I've learned is getting local businesses involved in the way that you get them to commit to send people. And they're people that were going to go anyway, but now they've got their company's endorsement to go, and they get the time off and maybe even get paid time to go. And in that way, you've got them sponsoring in a way that isn't giving you money, but also they feel involved, and it just blossoms from there in the corporate
Sure. That's a fantastic point, and that gets into getting the entire community involved. Another trick behind that is you show up to my store after an event and you get $5 off of whatever it is, or you get 10 cents off of your cup of coffee because you brought the flyer. And that also creates a social connection between whatever the establishment is and whatever the event is. Another.
Yeah, on the same note, don't just try to recruit people to come to your event, try to recruit organizations. So then even if they only bring two people, similar organizations will hear about it and bring their own people, and that's something that's worked for me, is going after groups and saying, hey, you'd be interested in this, do it.
Right, and that's why things like sponsorship are important. It's also why the Twitters are important, because, for example, with the badge stuff, we made Boing Boing, we made Gizmodo, we made Slashdot. I can now take that and point at those articles and say, hey, if you want to help sponsor the OpenAMD project right there, you should check it out. If you want to go and sponsor that, there's a really good chance that you're going to get your image, not just on everyone who's at the conference, but also on these sites that are interested in it. And suddenly you can take the identity and the reputation of those organizations, and you can harness those reputation points. So any more questions before I go on to the how to pull in speakers thing? Okay, cool. Because those are all really, really good points. Because the next question is, well, I have an event. How do I put it together? How do I get speakers? I'm sure Nauticon has been through this, trying to figure out, well, you issue the CFP, right, the call for papers. Well, how do I get people to see it? I've distributed it. How do I get people to register some degree of interest or acknowledgement? This can get kind of sneaky. There's a couple of ways to do this. One of my favorites, besides the nagging tricks, is to say, hey, have a conversation with them, maybe a 5-minute conversation, not even. Because the thing that you're going to run into most of all is, well, I have nothing I can speak on. I don't know what I can do. Because they haven't thought about it, and all they know is that they're being targeted for something, and you're trying to pull them into something, like, yeah, they want to hide in their little corner. So it's really important to talk with them and make that connection with them. So what are you interested in? Oh, you like programming. Okay, what kind of programming languages? Oh, you're working on a cool project. Well, that's kind of interesting. And more often than not, and this goes back into the Dale Carnegie stuff of how to win friends and influence people, the best way to make friends is to have them talk about themselves. Because when somebody talks about themselves, they feel like they're becoming important. And when you're talking with somebody who's talking about themselves, they feel like you think that they're important. And when somebody feels important, they feel magical. And they're willing to do a lot of different things. So when you reach out to somebody who's a potential speaker, you say, hey, what are you working on? What's cool? And they start telling you. Further, you have a number of ideas that you can pick on that you can then ask questions about. You like programming? What kind of languages? Are you doing any cool projects? Oh, you've done this and this. Oh, you've done that too. Okay, cool. And the best way I like to do this is catch them. You know, we've been talking for 10 minutes on this already. I'm pretty sure you can put together a 5-minute talk on it. So another trick that I've done for speakers that are super heavily reluctant is I pull the I need help. People always want to help out things at least in San Francisco, if it's something for the community, I'm pretty sure Nauticon is like this too. If it's something that's for the good of the community, people will always do it. So, look, I only have 7 speakers, we need 10. Can you please help me? And this is always something you go to somebody privately about, because if you do this publicly, it makes you look like an idiot. If you do it privately, you lower yourself from the promoter level down to the human level, and you make that human connection with them, they're going to start paying attention. They're going to be like, okay, well, I'm going to do it just this once. Or, okay, well, I'll tell you what, I'll help you out this one time. Get people to do favors for you because they're really doing a favor to themselves and they just don't know it yet. Yeah. Right. People help, like, to reemphasize that point, people helping people makes them feel good. You create that social connection. Further, when somebody is speaking, they've become part of that event. And one of the cool things I found is when you recruit people, and I'll get to this in a second. Well, actually, I should go to it now. When you pull people in, they become part of the team, and further, they're going to talk about it, because people like to talk about themselves. Hey, I'm going to be speaking at this event. Well, they're going to talk about the event, and suddenly everyone who's involved becomes a personal promoter of your own. And it's a way to delegate all that. It's a way to delegate the flyership, because you're speaking at this event. Okay, here's a couple flyers. Can you pass it to your friends just to make sure they have all the information so they'll catch your talk? Stuff like that. Which then gets into the next thing, which is schedules and deadlines. How many of you read through the entire Nauticon schedule? Jesus, really? Okay. when you've been doing an event for a while, nobody really reads the schedule. They just kind of show up. They know that something's going to be cool. Maybe they'll, you know, find something that catches their interest over time because they've already established that trust. They see the block. They see that familiar notion that, yes, the schedule exists, which means two things. It means the event is going to happen and that the people have their shit together enough so that they know that something will be there. The secret trick to this, and I'll cover this now. The secret trick to that, a lot of new event promoters and event organizers, they have a schedule and it's like, oh, it's structure, I have to stick to that structure. The trick is that nobody actually gives a shit. Nobody's gonna memorize the schedule and then call you on it when you switch things around. Because when you have a speaker who says, hey, I need to go early because I've got a meeting that you got scheduled, or somebody's like, dude, I'm in a traffic jam, or you know, my wife's in the hospital, something like that. Always let people change things on you and always let them drop out if they need to. Because if you have a speaker who comes in and is like, hey, I can't make it this month, can I do next month? Allow them to do that, because they're gonna suddenly have that trust. Hey, they recognize me as a person, they recognize me as a human being, they understand my needs. And that makes them more likely to come back again, that makes them more likely to say, hey, I had this experience with this person, and maybe they'll feel bad, I had to drop out, but hey, I have a friend who's interested in speaking, yes? Right. Well, to capitalize on that, one of the things that I have found, especially with people who drop out and they say, well, can I give this next month? What I always tell them is, rather than saying, yes, I'll save you for next month, I say, if you're still interested in it next month, then resubmit it as a regular talk. The reason being, they may have changed interest and they may want to be doing something else. Maybe somebody read a book and it inspired them to go do a different project. If they want to resubmit the same talk, that's great. But they might have another one, and by saying, yes, I'm going to sign you up ahead of time, that makes them feel like they're compelled to do something that they might not want to do.
Right. I'm gonna let you finish, but yeah, the deadlines bit, that's mm-hmm. something that we've been having a bit of an issue with. So.
Yeah, deadlines. So here's a good trick. Always make two deadlines, one for yourself and one that you give out publicly. Reason being, you want everyone else to freak out about stuff while you're calm. So you give all the speakers a deadline. Yeah, okay, so the event's on Thursday, so get your slides in by, I don't know, Friday or Sunday or something like that. You know, set a static time. But make sure that there is some grace period, right? Because nobody's ever going to get stuff in on time. It never happens. I didn't get my slides done until, like, last night at 4 a.m. And that's a given. That's always going to happen. People have things that come up. Life happens, right? But if they miss the deadline, if they slip past it, then they're going to feel a bit of guilt, and they're going to feel the social pressure that is created on themselves, because everyone wants to do a good job. Everyone wants to, like, make something good. So when they have that social pressure, rather than you going around and nagging everyone, they're going to be nagging themselves. And that's actually a really, really important point.
So in other words, it's putting out that public face deadline and
right.
having, like, that, you know, right. giving yourself that extra time.
Right. Well, I mean, everyone really has their own deadline. They see something depending on their level of involvement with it. Like, the organizer has, like, 8 different deadlines based on, you know, I need to make sure I have the projector set up, I need to make sure we have the microphone working, all that kind of stuff. The speaker's deadline is, I need to make sure I have my slides, I need to make sure I get to the event on time. The attendee, oh, I just want to make sure that I get there, maybe, you know, get some of my friends involved.
Right.
So everyone has a different type of deadline.
Like, example, the art show that we did, we had a deadline for the artist to come in and fill out a contract and everything, and most artists did that no problem. And the next deadline was, I think, 2 weeks before the actual event to submit the physical art. So but we got down to the wire to where it was like 2 days before, we're like, oh, where
right,
is all this
right.
art? And, I mean, it got down to the – people came through, but,
cool.
you know, there was a lot of worry about that. And I was wondering, is there any way to, have streamlined that better as far as, like
– So that's a great question, and unfortunately I'm running low on time,
right.
so I have to skip ahead to the rest. But we should discuss this in the break room where I'll be afterwards. So I need to run through the rest. I have a couple of videos that I want to show, but I want to touch on the basic structure of an event first. You have the schedule, which I went over already. Always have some kind of an intro like whether it's the open-end ceremonies. We did intro videos, which sadly I don't have time to talk about, or intermission styles. Because we had 10 five-minute talks, having some kind of a break between them, we learned that in September of 2009. Actually, even if it's still a steady progress, it's a change in tempo, and it makes everyone feel like they've had a rest, and they have the time to recharge and like go back and finish it up. So as I'm running a little bit on time, I'm going to jump straight to the crazy stories. So I'm going to cover the bingo game. This was really cool. So everyone here ever played bingo? Does anybody not know how bingo works? The idea behind bingo is that you can take elements of an event or elements of anything and create a grid. So for example, here we have the speakers wearing a hat, speakers wearing glasses, whatever else. We had, I think this was December of 09, we decided, hey, let's make a 5 minutes of fame bingo. And we constructed all these different squares based on the different elements. I got a video of this. Oh,
yeah,
hold on. Actually, that's going to be kind of hard to show without the sound. Can I get the microphone to see if I can wing it somehow? It's a short video, don't worry. Can you hear that? Okay, cool.
And bingo's a fun social game. You can do a bunch of variations of it. So we were trying to think of what would be a good way to integrate an interactive game into 5 minutes of fame. So in the beginning of the room, many of you can see there's a sign that says free booze and whatnot if you play. And it's these sheets that's 5 minutes of fame-o, or 5 minutes of fame bingo. And it's a 5x5 square, fast start in the middle, and each one of these squares is meant to represent something. Maybe speakers wearing glasses or has tattoos or something that's describing the speaker or something going on. And as you're going through this, just mark it up. When a speaker does something that matches, mark the square, the middle is free. And as I said before, you got to get 5 squares in a row to win. And this is the part where people need to start breaking across the wall. If you get a bingo during the talk, shout bingo. Interrupt the speaker. And that's going to be kind of fun to see how many people actually do this. And yes, mark squares, carry to the next. Somebody got a bingo already? Okay.
What 5 stupid jokes?
So, we'll get to that in a second. All right. So, also, mark squares do carry to the next speaker. So, it's not just a one-time, it's not one board for every speaker. This is for the entire thing. If you want to play 2 or 3 boards, go for it, whatever. Hack the system as much as you can. Now, if you get a bingo, shout bingo, because it's fucking bingo, right?
Bingo.
Now, here's the best part. Once you shout bingo, you have to stand up and walk over here. We have this area where you can form a queue, right? And to get a good bingo or a bad bingo, you have to justify it. You have to come up here, and after every talk, we're going to take all the people that are lined up, and we're going to go through their bingo and let the audience decide if they have a good bingo or not. There's not necessarily a wrong answer if you can be creative enough. And if you win, you get a shot of the booze of your choice. So we got a bunch of booze, and we got a bunch of stuff up here. So really, what's there to lose, right?
What'd they give the guy back?
What? They got a shot. The next example I'm going to go over, you guys...
Bingo.
What? Oh, fuck you. The next example I want to cover quickly is swings on the BART. This gets into... BART is the train system that runs through basically metropolitan San Francisco. And it's a train, right? You get on the train, you go to work. You get on the train, you go to school, whatever it is. It's something that you get on that takes you from point A to point B. Why put any special importance? So this was something we came up with that was a way to have fun while you're dealing with the monotony, because people are going to be on their way home, and they get onto the BART, and there's fucking swings on the BART. They're like, dude, what the fuck? And the idea, we played into a bunch, to get into the social dynamics would take a long time, but case in point, we set things up to encourage random people to get on the swings, because does anybody here hate swings? Okay, good, nobody. So the way that we orchestrated this was, there was 1 month of 5 minutes of fame. Mike, who orchestrated the whole thing, was the last speaker. So we had a bunch of people come to an event just like this, and he gave the basic demo of how it all worked, because they had done this previously. And he said, well, here's the ins and outs. I install it. You guys all get to ride and have fun. He explained the philosophy of it to everyone. And at the end, he's like, hey, I got four swings. Let's go fucking install these on the BART right now. And if you're in the audience right there, and you're seeing this, and you're thinking, okay, well, I've been playing along so far, but now I'm actually being pulled from my seat to go do some crazy stunt like this, what do you do? And it turned out that everyone went and they had fun. Let's see. I don't know if I have time. Cease and desist. We got a cease and desist order back in January of 2010 because the phrase is trademarked. And the EFF rocks. So I basically put this in there to say thank you to the EFF. Also, one of the things we have set up with NoiseBridge, if you send an email to our legal department, which is like legal@noisebridge.net, it gets cc'd to chillingeffects.org. So you can actually go there and check it out. That's a way that we can deter people from sending like bullshit lawsuits to us and things like that. Because anytime there's actually something of substance, we want to make it as public as possible. The event itself got the notice. We got the EFF to send a response. So finally, the final thing I want to go over is the dedication. About a year ago, my Uncle Tom passed away, and shortly after, my Grandma Dee did. And they are largely why I create events. Can I get the microphone again? I have one more video I would like to play before I conclude the talk. I'll get out of here as soon as I can. And I just want to point out, once you've created an event, or once an event exists, it's kind of a broadcast medium where you can help all these people connect with you. And once you have that connection, sometimes you need those people. So
normally I end this event by thanking everyone and bidding everyone a good night and whatnot, but tonight's going to be a little different. I've had a lot of very deep and personal things happen to me lately. And the first is that 2 days ago, my Uncle Tom died. Here's a picture of Uncle Tom as the best man for my father at my parents' wedding. Here's another picture of him with my dog Astro and my cat Arthur. He was the oldest of all of my aunts and uncles, and he introduced me to computers. I learned about computers by sitting with him in his basement or living room or wherever it was. And he would just like walk me through and explain what EBSs were, or when it started to get into what different games were, how things worked. And he introduced me to a lot of things that I've tried to bring to 5 minutes of fame in San Francisco. So this event, this evening, this month, is dedicated in part to him. It's also dedicated to my Grandma Dee, there's a picture of her at, I think that's her engagement with that other person. And that other person, my grandma's 55th wedding anniversary where they renewed their vows. And just a couple quick things to say. Sometimes there are times in our lives when we're forced to remember that we're not the most important people in the universe. So that's one of the reasons this is dedicated to them. And I had a brief poem that I wanted to read. One of my grandma's favorite poems that hangs up in her kitchen. It's a traditional Irish blessing. May the road rise to meet you. May the wind be always at your back. The sun shine warm upon your face. The rains fall soft upon your fields. And until we meet again, may God hold you in the hollow of his hand. I fly tomorrow for my uncle's funeral. And I want everyone to at least know who they are. So tonight is dedicated to them.
Any questions? Oh, all right, yeah, okay, I'm getting axed. I can take questions in the break room upstairs.